Welcome to Leading Lines, a podcast from Vanderbilt University. I'm your host, Derek Brough, Director of the Vanderbilt Center for Teaching. In this podcast, we explore creative, intentional, and effective uses of technology to enhance student learning, uses that point the way to the future of educational technology in college and university settings. In this episode, I'm very happy to share an interview with Zoe LeBlanc, a six-year doctoral student in history here at Vanderbilt University. Zoe studies networks, ideas, and spaces in modern history, and her dissertation examines the role of Cairo as a hub for anti-colonial activism in Africa during the Cold War. I met Zoe back in 2011 or 2012 when she became the Center for Teaching's first Haystack Scholar. Haystack is a network of academics exploring the intersection of teaching, scholarship, and technology. And I remember having a series of really fascinating conversations with Zoe that year as we explored together ways to bring the digital into our teaching. The following year, Zoe was a fellow at the Vanderbilt Institute for Digital Learning, where she continued her explorations of educational technology and helped launch a Conversations on Digital Pedagogy series that's still going strong. This year, Zoe is a fellow at Vanderbilt's new Center for Digital Humanities, and she continues to build and enrich the digital humanities community at Vanderbilt. I spoke with Zoe this summer, shortly after she arrived back on campus from one of her many trips to overseas archives. We talked about her experiments in digital pedagogy, her approach to using educational technology, and her career path as an aspiring digital historian. Well, Zoe, thanks for talking with me today. Can we start by having you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your doctoral research?
Sure. Well, thank you for having me, Derek. As you know, I've always been a big fan of your work and kind of the CFTs. And it was pretty instrumental the time I kind of joined you guys in 2012, I think, as a Haystack scholar. And since many moons ago, I've been working on my dissertation, but also kind of taking the stuff I've learned from the CFTs. So I'm a doctoral student in the history department, and I'm going into my sixth year in the fall. And I look at kind of international anti-colonial movements, but through the lens of Cairo in the 50s and 60s, and try to map both the kind of discourses, but also networks that underlie this kind of really brief moment of anti-colonial idealism that kind of shaped the immediate decolonization moment. And so that's what I spend a lot of my research time doing. I have spent the last kind of few years going to archives and just taking thousands and thousands of images that now sit on my hard drive that I'm now currently going through. So that's where I'm at the moment. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I'm you mentioned going to archives. I'm grateful that we have a chance to talk, because often when I ask to meet with you, you are in some other far part of the world.
Yeah, no, this is the first time I was telling you, the first time I've been in Nashville in the summer. Kind of mixed feelings. I was really excited about it, and then the weather happened. Now I'm kind of like, oh, maybe it was nice traveling.
Yeah. Well, tell us also a little bit about your teaching experience here at Vanderbilt.
So I've taught now four semesters in the history department. We're TAs there, but we also get to lead discussion sections. And so I've taught a whole kind of slew of courses, mostly focused on modern kind of historical topics, Cold War history. I did do a class on the Arab Spring, which was a lot of fun. And then I did a bit of an outlier class with the Chancellor, actually. We taught the Federalist Papers together, which was a really fun, almost kind of introduction to constitutional law course. And of course, at the time I was teaching it, Hamilton the musical came out, which was super exciting, kind of kicking myself that we didn't go on a class field trip to New York. But so I've mostly been kind of leading discussion sections and kind of trying to work with students to help them understand complex kind of historical topics and learn what, you know, thinking historically is, how to do research, how to write. Those kind of things.
Yeah. Mostly undergraduates?
Yes, all undergraduates.
All undergraduates.
Although from a lot of, I've been surprised at Vanderbilt, a lot of my students are kind of, you know, from the sciences or med streams, a lot of medicine, health, and society, you know, kind of econ and politics, really across the board, which is, I think, really cool.
Well, and I've always thought it was pretty neat that our chancellor teaches regularly. Undergraduates.
No, and I definitely learned a lot from him. And that course was just—it's a very intense. It's a three-hour seminar, and where we read about like 10 pages of the Federalist Papers. So you really do it, like the close reading model. But the students really loved it, so it was awesome.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk more about your teaching, but first I want to step back just a little bit. Yeah. You've been very active in the digital humanities community here at Vanderbilt. You mentioned your experience as a Haystack Scholar a few years ago. But I know you've been involved in lots of other ways here at Vanderbilt and really beyond. How would you define that term, digital humanities, for someone who's not familiar with it?
Yeah, this is such a great question. I always joke with people outside of academia that when I say I do digital humanities, it's kind of like humanities professors discovered computers and was like, you know, this might be something. But I do actually think it's a lot more than that. You know, it really can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different peoples, but to me, it really means kind of meaningfully integrating digital tools, digital infrastructure into our research and teaching, but then also looking back at those things critically and kind of applying the same type of scholarly analysis that we do to all our other spheres of our lives. And so, you know, for some people, that means kind of really going heavy on the digital pedagogy, which I kind of see as the, like, I don't know, the gateway drug into digital humanities. Yeah. I feel like everybody kind of starts off with their teaching. At least for me, being the Haystack Scholar, it was, you know, it made a lot of sense. And then as you go further, you're like, maybe this might help for my research as well. And then you start thinking about, well, who's making these tools, or like, where are they coming from? And then, like, you know, oh, what is this infrastructure that I'm even, like, you know, using, and kind of those questions. So that for me is kind of how I've both experienced, but also kind of define digital humanities. And I think just taking, you know, what we see as the kind of critical analysis of humanities and trying to both integrate digital into that, but also, you know, use that as a lens to critique these structures and think about them thoughtfully, I guess.
So we mentioned Haystack a couple of times, but I don't think we said what that is. Can
right.
you say a little bit about, I don't know what the acronym is.
Yeah, I know.
I can't remember that.
It's really the worst. I mean, it's a great, like, shorthand. I think it's Humanities, Arts, Science, Technology, Advanced Collaboratory. It ends on collaboratory, which is a weird word to end on.
Right.
So that's a program that I think you guys started in 2011 here at Vanderbilt, right? With Corey.
That's when we joined the national program.
Right, yeah. But it's this huge kind of international program now that kind of links digital humanities, you know, kind of a very broad sense of digital humanities. You have people coming from media studies. You even have some kind of comp sci people, I think. And just trying to bring them together in this kind of virtual space to blog and share ideas and kind of have a critical forum. And then they do this great conference every year that Vanderbilt's now sending like two panels to a year. Like, you know, we got like, a whole little entourage. But it's a really great conference to go to. It was actually the first conference I went to. It was in Toronto, and it is so different than the normal conferences. It's so much more laid back, but also, you know, people really engage in it. Not to, you know, dismiss other conferences, but there's a tendency in, I think, a lot of academic conferences that people kind of skip the panels or things like this. At Haystack, I feel like people really went to go engage, and then, you know, you have the Twitter back channel, which is awesome. So that was a great experience for me, and now it's, you know, it's kind of turned into this whole network on campus too, which is awesome.
I think we had maybe 10 Haystack Scholars this past year, sponsored by different centers around campus. It's a pretty cool, I've found it a nice way to kind of jumpstart our digital humanities community here, and to have people from around campus and different departments and different centers meet each other and interact and find common interests.
Well, and I'm actually going to be one of the digital humanities grad fellows next year at the new Digital Humanities Center that's opening.
Hadn't heard that. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. I'm super excited. When I saw that, I was like, I need this. You know, I'm getting close to ending, so it's kind of silly to do this at this time, but I was, you know, like you said before, I've spent a lot of time on this. I've gone to a lot of other places to learn about this. I've tried to build the network that I can to talk to people in this. So it's very exciting to have finally, you know, a home for all of this to live. Because Vanderbilt's really grown in the last few years in terms of people interested. But I think we've just been missing some of the infrastructure to help people kind of take it to the next level. And, you know, especially going to conferences and stuff like that. It's hard to get funding for these things, or, you know, buying a new computer, these kind of things where it's like, I've kind of had to invest on that in my own. So I'm very excited to see what this new center is. And hopefully, it becomes kind of another hub in the network, you know, another node.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about teaching.
Yeah.
I've got more questions about your own professional development and your career and all that, but
so do I.
But looking back on some of your teaching experiences, yeah. What are some ways that you've used technology yeah. to enhance the learning experience yeah. of your students?
Well, the way I got into it was both Haystack, but then also just being very frightened by Blackboard, right. which I think you're changing. But in the past, you know, it was such a horrible tool. And so for me, the immediate thing became, okay, I don't want to use this virtual space. I mm-hmm. don't feel like this is a great way for my students to understand the course and to kind of share materials. So the first thing I did was build a course website. And I think that was for, gosh, what was it? I think it was for my history of modern kind of Middle East US relations.
Okay.
And then from there, I kind of started thinking about, okay, how can we collect materials? How can we share them and get kind of expand the classroom outside of the walls, right? Continue the conversation. Because in some ways, you're just always struggling in class. You know, how much content can you go over? And where it really came together was the course I taught on the Arab Spring. That was a really exciting one because obviously the Arab Spring itself was almost a digitally born event, right? You can't really understand it without using digital tools. So for that course, I took a lot of what I had learned in the previous courses and tried to integrate digital from the get-go, because I mm-hmm. think a lot of people see, you know, ed tech or digital tools or digital learning as like 1 week in the course, like the way you kind of send your students to the library for one of the course meetings to learn what research is. And right. I think we all know that that's really, you know, it's a nice gesture, but it doesn't kind of integrate it enough. And so what I did was I had this kind of pretty robust WordPress site, but then I also had the students on Twitter. And we had a whole kind of back channel around the classroom hashtag. And I also had kind of Pinterest boards going and tried to really get them to start finding material from elsewhere and sharing it and having a discussion. Twitter was also great because I got them to do their reading responses there, which was helpful, A, to make sure they did their readings, yeah. But also helpful to just see what readings were kind of working and which ones weren't. I think it's always that awkward moment in a discussion section when you can tell nobody's done that particular reading and you kind of want to sit through the silence, but it's also like we have an hour. Like, do I want to fight you on this or not? And especially the Arab Spring, we were going through, you know, country after country, and most of these students, this was their only course on in history, let alone kind of, you know, Middle Eastern or North African history. So it was really about trying to get them to kind of start doing their own research and start seeing how these digital spaces could be both, you know, research kind of sources, like primary sources, but then also things that are ongoing. And one of the great things, I've told you this story before, is so the students were using hashtags, and this one student, we were doing a week on kind of Saudi Arabia and Islam, and he like tweeted about the Prophet, but like hashtagged his name. And that tweet went viral around Islamist circles wow. in Saudi Arabia, yeah. which was a really exciting experience. It was a great teaching moment because it was like, look, these are real communities out there. This is not like some cloistered discussion we're having in the classroom. It also brought up a lot of privacy questions, though, sure. that I hadn't thought.
Like, do you remember how many retweets it got?
I mean, you know, I could pull it up.
Dozens or hundreds? Or?
It was probably, you know, at the time, the class was so insular, it felt like it was like thousands, but right. it was probably like maybe like 50 or something.
Okay.
It was a lot more than anything else from the class
sure,
got,
sure.
though.
There's still a lot of right, actual and, eyeballs on that
right.
tweet.
Well, and you know, a very particular community, like when every Twitter profile is, you know, a sheikh with like a beard, like it's very
right.
noticeable
right, right.
about who is looking in. And, you know, I thought that was really, you know, great, but at the same time, brought up these questions for me about, okay, you know, what is the line between like public and private? Mm-hmm. I kind of fall to the side of I really want students to produce publicly because I, you know, as much as it's important to have space to share ideas and work through them, I think it's also important to be accountable. But I, you know, I also want to leave them space to, you know, maybe not share as much. Mm-hmm. So, for example, they could make a Twitter account with not their public name.
Sure.
And that's what I think a lot of people have come to. And I, you know, Vivian's work on Twitter and like the German kind of experiment she did in her class with like collaborative fiction writing, you know.
Right. This is Vivian Finch, who's assistant director here at the Center for Teaching.
It's such a fantastic, you know, and I would love to kind of push Twitter further that way. The 1 week that I did let it go a bit rogue was when I told them they had to retweet and reply to each other at least 4 times. And then I could barely keep up with the stream.
Wow.
Like, it just went kind of out of control. But then it was like, is this what I want or not, right?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's great they're having these discussions, but, you know, at the same time, how much control do you give up? And I really like these kind of moments, because it really makes you think consciously about how you're teaching and the kind of choices you're making, and makes them much more transparent. And I think normally happens.
So I have several follow-up questions.
Sorry, that was a bit long.
So let me unwind this a little bit. So you said you had 1 week where you asked them to retweet and reply to each other. So prior to that, had they largely been kind of tweeting out but not talking to each other?
Yeah, there was a few that clearly, I mean, there was a lot of pushback to using Twitter, which was surprising to me. So there's a lot of people that were new to it, didn't really understand how it worked. So I would definitely, in hindsight, do like an early kind of, this is how Twitter works.
Sure.
I definitely assume too much knowledge, you know, this whole myth of digital natives, right? And so
following Conan O'Brien on Twitter is not the same as engaging
exactly
in academic conversations on Twitter.
And making them rethink this as a tool that you can use for kind of, you know, scholarly discussions.
Yeah.
And so a few of them would like tweet out articles beforehand or like each other's or sometimes reply, but it wasn't a very robust discussion. Mm-hmm. But then that week where I did tell them to actually like engage with each other, then it just took off, and it was really cool. But it was, you know, it's so hard because especially sometimes on topics like this, people can have, you know, opinions that are not necessarily based on like scholarly material, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is, you know, current politics essentially. And so it's tough to, you know, want to allow them to express themselves, but then also want them to be more thoughtful and nuanced. And that's everybody's had that moment in discussion section where it's like, do I let them keep talking or do I step in? And on Twitter, it kind of got, you know, an exponential version of that, because how do you even step in, right? You can't be like, stop.
Right.
Pause button.
Right.
That's enough.
Did you start to intervene when they, I mean, or did you tend to kind of hold back and let them
conversation? I really wanted them to run the conversation. I mean, on something like this, they tended to look at me as such an expert that it kind of sometimes would shut down conversations. Or they were looking for like recognition on Twitter, like, oh, you know, she liked mine, like that means it's a point or something, I don't know. They interpreted this in interesting ways, and so I really wanted it to be more of an organic discussion. This also happened though towards the end of the semester, and I think after that we had papers, so it was just kind of, it was an experiment left unfinished, essentially.
Sure.
But it was interesting.
So the student whose tweet went viral, after that happened, what did you do either outside of class or during class to help process that with your students?
Probably not as much as I should have at the time. I kind of just, you know, made a grimace when I noticed, like, I should have thought this more thoughtfully. But I definitely started looking more at what people were doing with Twitter. I'd looked at previous stuff kind of through Haystack, but I think around that time people were starting to nuance much more their approach to Twitter as a tool in the classroom and as a space for the classroom. And I think for that student in particular, it was more just a cool thing. It wasn't necessarily, I tried to more get them to think about, okay, this is an actual community. I mean, a lot of this course was just getting them to realize that there was real people in this part of the world, and a lot of them the same age as them and going through like very different kind of life experiences. And so trying to get them to empathize. So it was more a good teaching moment for making that connection. But in hindsight, I would definitely try and think through more about getting them to understand what a hashtag does and what type of communities that links you into, and thinking more thoughtfully about in advance of the course, which hashtags should I tell them might, I mean, because it would be fun for them to experiment even, but I want it to be an intentional choice. I don't want it to be, you know, happenstance or haphazard. And then about the privacy stuff, I mean, I think a lot of this stuff is developing as you know, we go forth, the university, in terms of their policies on privacy, like, who owns this data? You know, also students realizing, like, is this my professional identity online? I mean, this is something even I struggle with, you know. What do you post online? Do you have a different Twitter account? Because in some ways, the nice thing about this is, you know, you can show that I was actually engaged in this later down the road, potentially. But that's also having the foresight to know where you might be down the road. So,
Yeah, those are tough calls. And honestly, I'm still working through in many ways. I have a professional Twitter account, and then I have a personal Twitter account.
Yeah.
And if I want to tweet about my kids or about whatever TV show I'm watching, I do that on my personal Twitter account.
Yeah.
And no one really cares, right? But it's fun, and I know a few people there, and that's fine.
Yeah.
But I try to kind of keep that separately. But sometimes I wonder, am I being a little too artificial?
I know.
Right?
I know.
I mean, these aren't real walls in my life, right? So, it's kind of an ongoing debate in my head as to how to talk about some things.
Right. Well,
and where to talk about things.
Exactly. And especially, like, college-age students. I mean, they're living these things so much, and it's such a kind of social space for them. So for them to understand that these can also be, like, professional scholarly spaces is incredibly important because, like, down the road, it might, you know, hurt them if they've not thought about this. But then at the same time, you don't want them to, like, I don't know. There's something about being honest and authentic online that can actually be very helpful, too, as a creative process. So it is a weird line to straddle.
Yeah. And I think what I hear often is kind of a risk-averse approach, which says, well, don't put anything online.
Right.
Don't put yourself out there. Keep it private. Keep it locked down because you don't want to say something that's going to get you in trouble later. But I think there is an... another way of looking at it that says that if you're not online and you're a professional and you're not engaged in scholarly or academic or professional communities, like, what does that say about you? Why aren't you there?
Exactly.
Right? And so I don't think the right answer is to always kind of shut down and lock down, but to be really intentional about what you put out there and how you represent yourself.
Right. And, you know, one thing I would have loved to do with the class that we didn't do was kind of have blog posts online, and this is coming from your work, right, with the cryptography class that you do, because I really think helping students understand that writing is a process and researching is a process is helpful when it's online and you can go back and look at that and, you know, make changes to it and work in a kind of more public space, because that's, you know, as scholars, we sit on stuff for so long, you know, getting an article out, like, it takes years, and it's such a weird way for knowledge to flow in this day and age, and so, you know, showing the students there is that model, there is that very, you know, scholarly traditional model, or not traditional, just, you know, there's that way to communicate information, but there's also a way you can do it more publicly and openly, but, you know, still be smart about it, but also realize that there is a process and there is a benefit from sharing these things, and you can, you know, see how your thoughts change over time in a way that, you know, I go back and look at blog posts I wrote and I'm like, oh my gosh, I should just take this down. Like, this is horrible, you know?
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's nice to see that, oh, this was, you know, me really trying to grapple with these issues.
Yeah.
And so, but that will have to wait for a future course, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know. I might be TAing this fall. We'll see. Still waiting on the news.
If you're in the country.
I'm definitely in the country now.
Right.
The traveling is done. I'm grounded.
You're grounded.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so we've touched on this already a little bit, but as you think about technologies that you want to experiment with or adopt in your teaching, what are some principles you keep in mind?
Okay.
How do you make those decisions about what to try or what to use?
Right. Well, there's a few different things that I really look for. One is that, you know, if I'm going to use this, there has to be a rationale. I think, you know, the big critique that a lot of digital humanities gets in digital teaching is that, you know, it's all flash, no substance.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's rarely the case, but I think people don't spend the time thinking about the rationale enough. And that needs to be front and center about what, you know, what are the benefits to the students? What is the benefits to the classroom? How is this helping me achieve X goals? I also look for stuff that I think is a platform or tool that I don't want to be paying for things. I want things to be free. I want it to be sustainable as much as possible. 'Cause, you know, it's a very frustrating thing to spend all this time teaching the students to use something that, you know, a year from now might not be available or it's not going to be accessible. So definitely trying to look at, you know, teaching them kind of principles of how to evaluate kind of the tools they're using and looking at, you know, what is the difference between like the data and sources we're using versus these tools to kind of analyze and maybe visualize them. And then I guess lastly from that, I just, and this is like a pet peeve of mine, but just like design, you know, I'm a big, an ugly website just kills me. Like I just, you know, want to throw my phone at the wall. Like it just, it doesn't do it for me. So, and I think just trying to find tools that really let you do what you want with them, that have enough flexibility and also have some eye to design, in the sense that, I mean, I really see it in the same way of research and teaching. They're so iterative. And I think, you know, design and like digital teaching or humanities, I mean, you really can't have one without the other. So I just, that's a pet peeve of mine, I guess. I just don't like tools that are really poorly designed. It just, I mean, they don't work well usually anyway, so why would you use them? But
are there other tools that you've either used or you find really interesting that you're thinking about using at some point down the road?
You know me, I'm like a shiny object person. I want to try them all. But, you know, for history, obviously, there's a lot of like mapping. And I, you know, and you did the timelines this year as well. And so that's two I would definitely integrate. The fun thing with those is oftentimes the endpoint you get to is not that it isn't great to use them, but you often end up with actually a pretty robust critique of what you've created, which I actually like to end at that point because it helps the students see these things not as, you know, flat or uncritical tools or websites or whatever form they come in, but something that, you know, all sorts of interpretive choices went into. And so I think that's really great. I'd like to do some Wikipedia more, just because my students use it so uncritically, and just getting them to realize how constructed that is would be really cool. I'd also love to get into, and this is really like, I'm not even sure I'd integrate this, but like, you know, some of the augmented reality or maybe like 3D printing, microprocessor, like computing stuff. A lot of the maker culture, I think, would be really cool. I mean, history is such a kind of text-based discipline, but the weird thing is a lot of our sources can be film, can be pictures, can be radio, all of these different mediums.
Objects.
And so trying to integrate that more and kind of push the students' understanding of what is historical or not, and also give them a chance to create as well. I really, you know, a lot of what I've thought about has come from listening to you talk of students as producers, and I really like that idea of, you know, not foreclosing where the endpoint is on a project, but letting them have some creativity and learn some skills that is really going to be helpful. I mean, it's a tough balance between content and skills, and I think we all struggle with that, but I do think there could be a little more experimentation in the history classroom, and so that's where I'm really at, of wanting to try and push the boundaries and see what's possible. Of course, I'm still TAing, so there's limits to what I can do, and you know, these poor students already have so many courses going on, but hopefully, you know, if a digital humanities course starts going in history, that would be a really fun place to kind of blend, you know, looking at these methods with also trying them out and understanding them.
Well, looking ahead to your own career, you said you're rolling into your sixth year. You're getting close to finishing.
The end is nigh. Hopefully, I don't know. It feels like there's a lot of writing to do.
There's a lot to do. I get that. As you think about possible next steps for you after you defend, what roles do you see technology playing in your teaching, in your research, in your professional development?
Pretty central. So right now, this is a bit of a spoiler alert, but I'm actually just started at the Nashville Software School in their part-time web developer bootcamp. So I'm spending the next year kind of learning how to be a web developer, because for me, I really came down to, where do you fall on this ed tech divide? Are you someone that, you know, might be getting the grants and kind of helping other people build the tools, or are you interested in building the tools yourself? And it turned out that, you know, I'm just crazy enough to think I can build these things. And so what I would like to see in my career is definitely continue in the digital humanities in some form or another, maybe as a professor, maybe as a staff member, but really starting to build more tools for our community, because a lot of the tools we have are really repurposed from other, you know, not like less savory contexts, but, you know, there's a lot of ways where we use the way we create and understand knowledge is not the same as like someone who's looking for business insights, right?
Or,
you know, any of these like big data companies. And so I would really love to kind of build new research tools and hopefully, you know, expand how we integrate kind of digital tools. I feel like in some ways we're almost in the like early dot-com boom of digital humanities, where there's a lot of promise and we're still trying to catch up there. But I think we will get there eventually, but that right now the frustrating thing I think for a lot of people is just the limitations in these tools and the way they were designed. And you know, the fact that you either have to spend so much money to get access or you can't share things. I mean, my big beef is that historians do not share archival data really well, which, you know, I've just spent the last few years having to travel to these archives and sitting next to people, like, taking picture after picture. It's just like, why aren't we sharing these things? Mm. It seems like a really weird inefficiency if these are all in some digital form. And so just trying to kind of integrate more thoughtfully the digital already into how we work, and then from there try and see what type of research we can do and see what's, you know, what type of questions. There's a great Cameron Blevins is this historian who has a great blog. He's historying, like the verb, I don't know, on Twitter, but he has this great thing about the promise of digital humanities and about how a lot of people have been really excited for this but haven't really gone the next step of really integrating it and pushing forward research boundaries or, you know, trying to push for new avenues, and that still needs to be done, I guess, and that the hard thing is we're kind of captives to our own claims of, you know, what this can do, but then we actually have to show that and push it forward. Yeah. So that's where I'd like to be. I mean, right now the job market is so interesting for academics and historians. I mean, I would love still to teach and do that. I mean, there's a whole, we could touch on a whole set of issues that I'm sure you could talk about being at a center, but not necessarily, you know, the kind of weird dual stream where you have like an appointment in a department, or you teach in a department but you're based at a center, and what that means for your ability in a campus to kind of enact change,
whether you're faculty, whether you're staff, and what those implications
Well, and also ownership of IP and stuff like this. I mean, this is something where now that I'm starting to build things, it's a very different way of thinking about my output and you know, the value of it and its relationship to the university. And so I mean, that's another podcast. Second podcast. But so that's where I'm at right now. And hopefully I'll finish in the next like year or two. I'm lucky enough to not have a gun to my head with the funding situation.
Sure.
So and now I'm actually starting to integrate more kind of text mining and mapping tools into my dissertation just to deal with the sheer amount of data I have. So I'm also excited to see what kind of research spins out of that, I guess.
We have one question we ask all of our guests. What's your favorite analog educational technology?
I was telling you earlier, it's so funny because we treat analog as just like, that's the natural classroom, this is how it's looked for eons,
right?
You know?
You
know, this is going to sound so bad, but candy is one I really love because it really does, you know, the simple incentive. Students just, they fall for it every time. They get really
kind
engaged.
Kind of a biotechnology, I guess.
Yeah, right? Maybe halfway in between. Besides that, I would say definitely, you know, a nice table where everyone could sit around. That's the ideal. Of course, most lecture classrooms can't can accommodate that, but you're fixing that with the flip classroom stuff, you know.
We're trying.
Get the lectures outside of the classroom. But
Where can we find you online, Zoe?
So Twitter, Zoe_ LeBlanc. I actually also own Zoe LeBlanc, but I can't get into it. So it's just a picture of me at like 5, which is like this weird sub account.
I have 2 versions of me on Facebook.
Really?
Because I joined when I was teaching at Harvard.
Oh.
And I used my Harvard email address when Facebook was just getting started. And then when I moved to Vanderbilt.
You were part of the early days?
I was. I was like, you know, in the first 2,000 users. But then I moved to Vanderbilt, and when I changed my email, somehow it forked my account. And so now there's like a ghost version of Derek still on
evil
Facebook
Derek.
Somewhere. He's only got 3 friends, so he must not be very likable.
Yeah, definitely evil. Yeah, so there's Twitter, and then my website's just zoeleblanc.com, and you can find all my email address, poorly written blog posts. They're all there for you.
Yeah. Well, Zoe, this has been a great conversation. Thanks for chatting with us about digital pedagogy.
It's been my absolute pleasure, Derek, and I'm really looking forward to hearing this podcast, so thank you.
Great. That was Zoe LeBlanc, a doctoral student in history at Vanderbilt University. Zoe is so thoughtful about digital pedagogy, and I'm glad we could feature her on the podcast. In the show notes, you'll find links to Zoe's website, her Twitter account, the Haystack Network, Vanderbilt's new Center for Digital Humanities, and a couple of other resources that Zoe and I mentioned. You can find those show notes on our website, leadinglinespod.com. You can also find us on Twitter, where our handle is @leadinglinespod. Leading Lines is produced by the Vanderbilt Center for Teaching, the Vanderbilt Institute for Digital Learning, the Office of Scholarly Communications at the Vanderbilt Library, and the Associate Provost for Digital Learning. Look for new episodes the first and third Monday of each month. I'm your host, Derek Bruff. Thanks for listening.